Today's Taisho will be on case 38 in the Book of Serenity. Case 38 is entitled Lin Ji's True Person. Introduction: taking a thief for one's son, taking a servant for the master. Can a broken wooden ladle be your ancestor's skull? A donkey saddle rim is not your father's jawbone either. When breaking earth, separating reeds, how do you recognize the master? Lin Ji said to the assembly, there is a true person with no rank who goes out and in through the portals of your face. Beginners who have not yet witnessed it, look, look. A monk came forward and said, what is the true person of no rank? Lin Ji got down from the seat, grabbed and held him. The monk hesitated. Lin Ji pushed him away and said, the true person of no rank, what a piece of dry crap he is. Verse. Delusion and enlightenment are opposite, subtly communicated with simplicity. Spring opens the 100 flowers in one puff. Power pulls back 9 bulls in one yank. It's hopeless. The mud and sand can't be cleared away. Clearly blocking off the eye of the sweet spring, if it suddenly bursts forth, it would flow freely. Thank you very much for coming to practice Zazen this morning on this wintry day. I know you had to drive very carefully to get here, and one person came in and said, oh my gosh, it was so slow, it took me so long to get here because of the roads. So thank you. It's always quite wonderful to sit together, even if it's challenging sometimes to make it happen. So, this is a very famous koan by a monk named Lin Ji, Rinzai, Lin Ji. Lin Ji became really quite an influential person in the history of Chinese Buddhism, in the history of Chinese, especially Zen, Chan, with his teachings of the original person, true person of no rank. So, it's important to understand a little bit about why Lin Ji's teaching became so influential, and people found it so liberating. In China, you might not realize this, but everybody in China had a rank. The emperor had a rank. He was the emperor. And under the emperor, there were officials, government officials, and they all had ranks. And under them were other officials who had ranks, down to like provincial officials and even like city officials. And in order to get to be an official, you had to compete with other young, it was only men at this time, you had to compete with other young men in a very rigorous system of exams. So people would, basically plan for their children, their sons, to take the imperial exams. And if they passed the imperial exams, their lives were likely to be quite prosperous. They were likely to be quite rich and powerful people. And so, you know, all over China, people would pick a son. They might not be able to educate all their children, but they might pick one of their sons to study for the imperial exam. And pretty much, you know, that son would be studying for the imperial exams all his childhood. And it involved many different things. It involved learning Chinese poetry. You had to know a lot of poetry. It would be like you would have to like memorize a lot of Shakespeare. And you'd have to be able to write essays on Shakespeare. And you had to know Confucius. You had to know the Analects, the Book of Rites, other classics of Chinese civilization. You had to know them back and forth. You had to know, had to have a huge vocabulary, so you had to know all the characters for different words. And you had to have perfect penmanship, perfect calligraphy, right? There were actually like exam periods where contestants for these very small number of positions would go. And all day you'd go into a little room, you'd be locked into the room with a your brushes and paper. And you were supposed to reply to the question, and at the end of the exam period, they would let you out and collect your response. So it was incredibly rigorous, and many, many really brilliant people didn't pass their imperial exams. But if you passed, you didn't just get a pass, you passed at a certain level. And if you were the very highest level, you would get to be a very senior government official. If you were less high, you would be a junior government official, maybe in the capital. And if you were less good, you'd maybe be a governor official in a province, a government official in a province, and then, you know, in a town if you, you know, got through the exam, but not very well. So, you know, if you go to a museum, in San Francisco, there's a wonderful museum with a collection of Chinese art. And one of the things it shows are different insignias that the different levels of bureaucrat actually wore. So, you know, if you were a bureaucrat of a certain level, you got to wear an insignia that was on the front of your robe, and it was like a crane. And others had, like, dragons. If you were very high up, you would get, there were various kinds of dragons. And there are other other creatures, too, that were represented on your clothing to show your rank. And most people in China did not pass their imperial exams. In fact, most people in China couldn't read or write. You know, most people in China, like 95%, were farmers. And they basically grew rice and all the food that kept the society going. And there were merchants. There were like 4% of the population or 5% of the population were merchants. And that was pretty much the society. So it was like government officials at the top. And then they were all scholars, right? Scholar bureaucrats. And then there were merchants. And then there were farmers. And then, of course, there were very poor people, you know, who had nothing. They were almost like serfs. So a similar thing was true in Europe as well. But China was so highly organized. It was such a structured system. And many people in China psychologically felt badly about themselves, right? I mean, everybody had a rank. It's not so different from our society today. You know, basically, we also have a very status-driven society. You know, even if you're an academic, if you work in a university, you know, there's not just professors, there's different ranks of professor. So, you know, if you if you're an English professor, you can be an assistant professor, you can be an associate professor, You can be a professor, and then there's even higher. There's an even higher rank called a distinguished professor. And believe it or not, there's a very small rank even higher than that where you have what's called a titled chair. So you could be the Kenneth Burke Professor of Rhetoric, and you could also be like the Kenneth Burke Distinguished Professor, right? Now, you know, professors don't wear insignias on their clothing, fortunately. But also this tendency to rank people. You know, if you take a class with an assistant professor, an associate professor, a professor, and a distinguished professor, you may not notice any difference in the intelligence and quality of the class. In fact, you know, sometimes the distinguished professors are really exciting, sometimes they're not. And sometimes the assistant professors are really exciting, and sometimes they're not. And it's also true for their work. You know, if you read somebody who's a distinguished professor, sometimes you think, I don't know. Whereas you might read something by somebody who's a young graduate student, and it might be terrifically exciting. So, you know, we have this tendency to rank everybody, just as the Chinese did. And I think in America today, people often feel similarly insignificant or unimportant. You know, I have a friend of mine who is an associate professor. He's been an associate professor for 30 years. And he's very, you know, I know we've never discussed it, but I know it bothers him that he's never become a professor. You know, he's one of the most intelligent people I've ever met, and he's extremely knowledgeable. But, you know, he had to have like a third book, basically, to get promoted to the top rank. He's published all these articles, but he hasn't done the book. So, you know, there are people who actually take this ranking seriously. And I hope he doesn't, because he's such a talented and intelligent person. But at any rate, in China, at the time of Lin Ji, you know, everybody was ranked, and people who were at the top definitely felt they deserved to be, and people who were at the top looking down at others often felt so much better than those others. And I would say a lot of people in China, as in the United States, had an inferiority complex. A lot of people felt badly about themselves. They felt they hadn't really achieved eminence, or they hadn't lived a life that was worthy of being lived. Lots of people felt that way. So, you know, Lin Ji was this Zen master, and he taught people this idea that he said everybody has a person of no rank. In other words, you know, you might or might not be the CEO of your company, you know. You might or might not be a distinguished titled professor. But no matter who you are, you have this Buddha nature inside of you. And for most people, you know, they're sort of strangers to this Buddha nature. But if they could only encounter it, they would realize how unimportant all this other stuff really is. You know, when we look back on the history of, say, China, or the history of the Roman Empire, you know, and you look, you might read about some government official in some province of Rome, you know. Nobody cares, you know. Nobody remembers those people, you know. At the time, they thought they were the most important people in the world, but when we look back on it now, we see not much of that really mattered. It really didn't matter what rank people were. So, you know, Lin Ji wants people to realize that these rankings, this way of making some people feel superior and some people feel inferior, was psychologically very destructive, but also false. You know, it makes people, everybody, even people at the top, feel badly about themselves. And Linji wanted to change the way they thought about who they were and what it meant to be alive by talking about something he called this person of no rank. See? So, basically, Linji became famous for this teaching, and people would hear this, and they would wonder what this was, and then they'd start practicing with Linji, and he was constantly directing their attention to this person of no rank, and this became hugely liberating for people in the Tang Dynasty. So, who is the person of no rank? Well, it's very important, I think, to realize that you were alive before you were Melanie or Kurt or Sandy. You were alive before then. Now, we know this, right? Biologically, it's true. You know, long before I was Kurt, I was already born. Not that long, but somewhat long. And in fact, you know, before I was Kurt, I was already alive. Even before I was human, I was already alive. You know, I was reading in the newspaper the other day, a scientist, I guess he's a Japanese scientist, but the article was actually fascinating. He said all terrestrial life comes from fish. I'd never thought of that, but it has to be true. He said all terrestrial life comes from fish. And what he's doing is tampering with fish genes. Because what they think happened was that fish fins began to elongate into arms and legs. This is like we see a tadpole. This happens to tadpoles, right? Tadpoles start out as fish, basically, and they turn into frogs. Well, this happened in the history of life on Earth, too, that there were fish who began to develop arms and legs. And they've actually found some skeletons of this. And when they had arms and legs, they began to walk out of the water. And they developed a different breathing apparatus, lungs, instead of gills and so on. All of this took a long time. But the professor said he's changing he's putting mouse genes into some fish and watching arms, the fish develop arms. But the professor went on to say, you know, actually, he said, when we're in the womb, we go through, or we recapitulate, many of these stages of evolution for a period in our evolution in the womb, our development in the womb. We actually have gills. And I didn't know that. I thought that was fascinating. So, you know, for a little while, we're fish. And then, you know, the gills go away and we develop lungs. But in the womb, as we're developing into so-called human beings, we go through a fish phase. We were a fish before we were human, and I was a fish before I was Kurt. Actually, this name, this Kurt, is very artificial, this name Kurt. You know, I predate Kurt by at least 9 months, you know, maybe more. And I have been different things long before I was Kurt. I was a fish. I was something else. I was a few cells floating around. And when you come into the world, you don't have a name. And your parents give you a name, but it doesn't become your name for a while, right? I mean, maybe on your birth certificate it says Kurt. But, you know, you don't know you're Kurt for, like, more than a year. Or maybe 6 months, anyway. You know, you're not Kurt yet. You're experiencing the world, right, in all kinds of ways. And the world is not yet defined very clearly. It's very open. You know, and you you know, you begin to notice at a certain number of months, you begin to notice your mother, and you know, zero in on her eyes, and you begin to have a relationship with your mother. And you know, people speculate that it's through that relationship that you begin to develop your sense of self. You know, basically you develop a sense of self by interacting with your mother and then with other people. And at some point they start going, Kurt, would you like, you know, would you like some, you know, applesauce? You know, and I don't remember, but I imagine I wasn't quite sure what Kurt was, but I definitely wanted some applesauce. You know, so you smile and you get the applesauce. And then a little later, your mother says, Kurt, would you like to, would you like your blanket? And pretty soon you begin to think of yourself as Kurt. And this process goes on and on for a long time. And after a while, we sort of forget, I think, that we weren't really Kurt. You know, we were something before we were Kurt. And as our world, as we mature into society, it becomes very important that we play a certain role, that we become Kurt. And people actually have expectations about what Kurt is supposed to be like, and they sometimes it's because they love us, and sometimes it's not. They definitely want us to stay within those boundaries. You know, it's the case that, I mean, my sister was definitely a tomboy. Laura is her name. And when she was a kid, she was not what you would call, I've known people who have daughters who are, one of my good friends has a daughter, and from the time she was about 3 or 4 years old, she got into dressing up in beautiful clothes, like gowns, and for Halloween, she would always be like the princess. You know, she was definitely into that. One day I was, you know, in the gym where I work out, they actually have a place where kids can go too. And around Hollywood, Halloween, I was coming out of the gym one day early in the morning, and they were bringing all the kids, and there's like a daycare there. And there were like 50 princesses coming in, you know, little princesses. So, you know, I have a friend whose daughter would have been right in the swing with all of those little girls. But my sister wasn't like that. She really didn't want to be a princess. You know, she wore, I think she must have seen To Kill a Mockingbird, right? Because she wanted to wear those overalls like a scout, if you've seen that movie with Gregory Peck. And she always wanted to do things that were sort of like boy things, right? And my mother was always trying to get her to not be so boyish and to be more like a girl. You need to be more like a girl. And I can remember my sister's face looking like, you know, sort of pinching up, like, I don't want to be that, right? And you know, I think my sister worked it out. She sort of worked out a compromise with my mother. You know, like she'd wear a dress to school sometimes, but you know, after school, she wanted to wear blue jeans, and she did many things that were sort of like you would say boyish, right? So you know, my sister is, you know, really understood that she's not really a girl, and maybe not really a boy. Those are really arbitrary identities. You know, and as we grow up, though, it's more and more important that we stay within these boundaries, you know. So You have to, my sister had to start wearing a dress. She had to walk a certain way, you know. I had a colleague, Susan, her name was Susan, and she also had a daughter who was kind of like my sister. And she had one daughter who was the princess, and the other daughter was like the tomboy, right? And I remember Susan bringing her daughter, the tomboy daughter was named Miranda. And I remember she brought her daughter to work, and I was sitting in my office looking out, and Miranda had was in her blue jeans and her sneakers, and she had climbed up this tree, right? And she was sort of like tearing one of the limbs off the tree. She's become like an environmental scientist. She's got a PhD in environmental science. But I think my friend Susan also had this kind of tension, like, you know, is Miranda going to fit into society? She's just not, quote unquote, feminine. And, you know, I've talked about the fact that I had that problem myself. You know, I go to a gym every day, every other day after I sit, if I don't have to teach early in the morning. And everybody at the gym, you know, I'll go into the gym and they'll all say, "Did you see the Steelers game last night?" You know, I want to tell you the truth. I have never seen a football game. I don't like football. I have never liked sports. You know, I like baseball, but I have never liked football. I've never seen a football game. And you know, everybody assumes I'm in the swing, right? They'll say, "Did you see that game last night?" And you know, I'm supposed to, you know, you take a vow when you take a vow to tell the truth. One of the precepts is you tell the truth, but you know, I don't want to be a square, so I'll say, "Oh yeah, you know, yeah, that was really something," you know. And sometimes there's a guy named Edwin in my gym, and he knows football history like back to the beginning of the game, right? He said, "Do you remember that game in, you know, 82 where so he dropped the ball?" You know, it's like, you know, I always say, "Edwin, I really don't remember that game," you know. And I hope I never do, you know. I don't say that part. But it's part of being, people have a generous spirit and they're bonding with each other, right? But it's a good thing, right? I mean, it's a good thing. They're bonding with each other, but they're also sort of like reassuring each other, you know, about the realness of this identity. You know, little boys work really hard to be men, just like little girls work really hard to be women. And you have to perform your womanness or your manness, you know, impeccably, or at least convincingly, right? And you know, if you don't do that, you know, people look at you a certain way. It's like you're not playing the game, or something's wrong with you. I teach an essay about men in Italy, and they were talking about how in southern Italy it's very important to do these manly things, you know, to be into soccer, and perform your manly identity. And they were talking about this man in this village who was not he was definitely they said he was kind of a failure at being a man. Because, you know, he didn't like to go out and drink with the guys. He liked to stay at home and read poetry, right? And he wrote poetry. And he did get married, but he was the only man in town who would, like, push the baby carriage through town, right? You know, and this was considered, like, shocking, right? And it was said he was like an outsider because he wasn't doing the man things. And he read poetry, which is unheard of in this town, right? So you know, we all get caught up in this in some way or another. You know, we have to play these games as we grow up. And it causes a lot of anxiety and actually suffering, right? because, you know, you're policing yourself all the time. You're supposed to fit into these roles, and the roles are accidents of history. You know, nobody planned this out. You know, someday people will be amazed that any humans ever played football. It's such a damaging game. You know, half the people who play suffer brain damage. You know, someday people will think, did they really do that to themselves? But, you know, when I was growing up, everybody in my high school who had any self-respect tried out for the football team. Since I had no self-respect, I didn't try out for the team. And my brother tried out for the team, but fortunately he was too thin. And the coach sent him home and said, you'll be killed out here. And actually, he had all his teeth. He didn't have a concussion. Very lucky. He was lucky. But this is this is like the rituals we go through. And we can, you know, I can remember, you know, friends of mine who tried out for the football team and they couldn't sleep for a week, right? You know, I've got to get on the team. You know, I've got to get on the team. And then when they didn't get on the team, it was like their lives were wrecked, right? And we go through this again and again in our lives, right? I mean, when I got tenure at Rutgers, it was a wonderful day, right? It was great. You know, it felt great. But, you know, I know so many people who didn't get tenure who have gone on to be super... scholars, super writers, great thinkers. You know, there's a guy I admire so much. He's an anthropologist named Gregory Bateson. And I was reading a man who went to find Gregory Bateson. Gregory Bateson was like a very famous anthropologist. But, you know, when this guy went to meet him at his department, he went into the anthropology department and he said, I'm looking for Gregory Bateson. And everybody looked at him like, why do you want to talk to Gregory Bateson? And Gregory Bateson was down in the basement of this anthropology building, and he had never become a full professor because he hadn't published the kind of work that the professors wanted, right? He had written this other stuff that actually got translated into 20 languages and went all over the world and has had a huge impact. But I was reading that they tried to promote him to full professor, but his department voted him down. See, this goes on all the time, right, to us. And we, if we identify too closely with these roles we're supposed to play, we can do ourselves a lot of injury, cause a lot of suffering. It's easy to point out how meaningless a lot of this stuff is. It's nice to get promoted. I'm not knocking it. It's nice to be a professor. It's wonderful. But you know, libraries are full of books by distinguished, titled professors that nobody reads, right? That's just a fact. You can go over to the library here, and you can, you know, you could, if you wanted to do the research, please don't bother, but you could research distinguished Rutgers professors in the English department or history department, and you could go and find their books, and you can be certain nobody has checked their books out in 30 years. You know, when I got to Rutgers, there was the guy who was the most eminent professor in my department was a man named Richard Poirier, who is long deceased. And all the young graduate students, Richard Poirier was from New England, and he had a very heavy New England accent. So when I first met Richard Poirier, I could barely understand him because his Yankee accent was so heavy. And then I went to a talk he gave, and he was talking about the modern literature. It's a modern literature. And I thought, what is modern literature? What's modern? It's modern literature. And all his graduate students would imitate him. I'd see these graduate students in the hall going, are you studying modern literature? So they wanted to be like him. He was the king of the English department 30 years ago. If you ask people in my department who is Richard Poirier, most people don't know who he is. See? So if you were eating your heart out because you weren't Richard Poirier, spare yourself that suffering. You know, that way of living is an unhappy way of living. Not just because, you know, for so many reasons, but one of them is you're not discovering who you really are. Who you really are. And I would say Zen is all about discovering who you really are. Now, you know, if you go to the bookstore, if you go to the few remaining bookstores on Earth, like Barnes & Noble on Route 22, you know, they have a whole section of books on self-help. And you can go, and their books are full of advice about how to get to know yourself, et cetera, et cetera. But if you read these books, and I have read a few of them, I think you'll find them disappointing. Because when they're talking about the self in those books, like self-help, they're still talking about the self that you were introduced to as a child and have been required to continue to inhabit. They're not talking about what Zen calls your real self, the person of no rank. So, you know, a lot of these books are advice books about how to be closer to a socially acceptable self, which is okay. Please be a socially acceptable self. But some of these books are, they're sort of like, and if you're really not interested in football, how can you fake it so your friends will like you, right? Enough facts to get by, enough football facts to get by. Those books are still kind of, they're supposed to be medicine, but they're only treating the symptoms. They're not treating the disease. You know, finding a socially acceptable self is important. You know, it's good to be liked by others. It's good to know how to work with people and get along. It's good to be friendly. I try to be the best teacher. When I go into the room and teach, you know, I'm always smiling and friendly no matter what my students say. I try to be encouraging, you know, and act like I'm fascinated. Sometimes I really am, and sometimes I'm not. But I want them to feel encouraged, right? So it is important to be able to do that. When I'm in a department meeting, you know, things don't always go my way. People don't always agree with me. I don't fly off the handle and get excited and angry. You know, I laugh and I go along with what people want to do. Those are all life skills that are important. But it's really, really, really important to find the person of no rank. You know, when you sit down on the cushion and you begin to watch your breath, you know, people who do Zen very often, I would say, experience something about it as liberating. You know, so there's a young man who's been coming to sit. He isn't here today, but he's been coming to sit almost every day. And it's amazing. You know, he came here to sit. He tried it, and he said, "Oh, I really like this. I'll come back." You have no idea how many people say that and don't come back. But he came back, and he's been coming every day. And I said to him, "How is this working out for you?" He said, "Oh, this is amazing. This is wonderful." You know, many people who don't come back also find it wonderful. You know, for various reasons they don't come back. But you know, why is it wonderful? What is it about Zen? You know, when people, it does click with people. What is it that clicks with them? You know, and I think a big part of it is that you're starting to step out of all these. It's not the only thing. But a big part of it is you're starting to step out of all these games you've been playing all your life, or at least since you were a fish in your mother's womb, right? You know, all these games you've been playing at being Kurt or being Bill or being Susan, you know, and it's so refreshing to step out of those and realize, wait, there's more to my life than Kurt. You know, I thought that was all there was. I forgot that there's something more to me than that, you know. There's something more to my life than that. And I think it's tremendously liberating to realize, you know, Kurt is just a small part of who I am. You know, I think that's one of the most liberating things about, you know, for most people, their identity is who they are. And if you said to, you know, I have a friend who is a psychotherapist. And sometimes we'll go to lunch and talk, and she's a psychodynamic psychotherapist. And she was talking about, the self and discovering yourself I said, you know, self is nice, but it's not everything. And she was like thunderstruck. It's like, what are you talking about? You know, what else is there to yourself but yourself? Right. It was interesting to me to see such an intelligent person and such a talented and gifted person had never really thought about this, you know? That the self is just a small part of who we are. Psychotherapy is addressing the self and its needs, and that's very important. And if you don't understand yourself, you can have a lot of suffering. But even though that knowledge is very important, you know, it's not all you are. And when you sit down on the cushion and you begin to watch the breath, you just start getting outside of yourself. And the self is often associated with all of these mental habits that are familiar to us. So, if you're a worrier, right? Maybe you're the kind of person who obsesses over small details, and you're a worrier, right? You know, when you're in your worrier mode, you feel grounded in yourself, you know. Even if it makes you unhappy to worry so much, it's familiar territory to you. It's kind of who you would say, this is who I am, right? I'm a worrier. Well, you know, actually, when you start sitting down on the cushion, you sort of leave eventually, if you practice, you leave the worrier self behind. You know, you get to a place where you stop worrying, or the worrying goes far over into the distance, and your consciousness is now focused on the breath. You know, and at that moment, it's probably, if you think about it, you know, it doesn't feel like you. You know, it doesn't feel, when I'm in that state, I'm watching the breath and I'm entering samadhi, and I enter Ushin, it doesn't feel like Kurt anymore. It really doesn't. And, you know, that's because it's not Kurt. It's something else. There's more to my life than Kurt. Kurt is a small, if there's a big Venn diagram, there's a little circle inside that's Kurt. And most people think that circle is all there is in their life. But when you do Zen, you realize, no, that's just something I do. I'm Kurt certain times of the day, basically. But I'm not Kurt, essentially. And when I sit down on the cushion and I watch my breath and I enter Mushin, enter emptiness, you know, suddenly Kurt is kind of gone. You know, your self-referencing stops. It maybe not for the full half hour, but a lot of the time it goes away. And people get off the cushion, and if they have had a positive sit, they don't understand why it's positive. They just know it is, but one of the things that makes it positive is that you're stepping outside of the confining limits of that identity as Kurt or Jim or Susan. And it feels so good. It's profoundly liberating to realize that there's more to your life than Kurt. There's more to your life than Susan. You know, it's a big world out there, and we get trapped in this little self. You know, and when you're really in deep Mushin, you know, and you come out of deep Mushin, the boundary between yourself and the world is very porous, right? You know, in fact, you know, if you're in deep samadhi and you're sitting in a room where you can hear things outside, this room is very quiet. But like at Sesshin, if it's day two of Sesshin and you can hear the birds outside, if you just listen to the birds, it's very difficult to say where you start and where the sound of the birds stops. In fact, it's impossible to draw that line very clearly. And when you begin to spend a lot of time in samadhi, you realize that, you know, the boundary between ourselves and the world is very porous and it's very blurry. That we're somewhere here, but it's very difficult to say where. I'm just talking about how we actually experience the world. You know, our common sense says, no, I'm Kurt, and my body is Kurt. And what's not my body is not Kurt. But actually, that's not true. When you're in deep samadhi, you realize, you know, actually, it's very hard to say if that sound is me or not me. You know, it's very hard, if you're feeling cold and you've been in samadhi, very hard to say if that cold is you or not you. That boundary becomes very porous. And you realize how arbitrary these limits are, that we actually, it's very important if you do Zen not to take common sense too seriously. You know, don't trust what people think. Trust your experience. So, you know, the Buddha was actually asked about this. There's a wonderful early Buddhist sutra called the Sutra to the Kalamas, K-A-L-A-M-A-S. And somebody actually said to the Buddha, how do we know if something's true? And the Buddha gives him a list of things not to trust. And one of the things he says is don't believe something because it was written down in a book. He said, don't believe something because an important or prestigious person told you it's true. Don't believe something because all your friends believe it. And he goes through this whole list. And he says, what you have to do is experience it yourself and then assess it, right? Assess it in terms of how it affects you. So it's really a wonderful sutra. But, you know, you can't trust common sense. You know, because if I go to the gym and I said, what does it mean to be a man? They all say, well, it means you like football, of course. That's common sense. Well, don't trust that. And if I went into my gym and I said, how many of you are interested in the poetry of Wallace Stevens? You know, nobody, I'm sure. If I did that and somebody was interested, I think I might have a heart attack. I would bet nobody reads Wallace Stevens except me. So it's okay, I'm not putting them down. But I don't have to accept their common sense as real, see. I tried poetry myself and I like it. I did what the Buddha said. I read poetry and thought, I like this, you know. I'm not interested in football, but I do like poetry. You know, and your common sense says your body is the limit of yourself. But if you practice meditation, you realize the body is not the limit of yourself. That's an arbitrary limit that's been imposed on you by common sense. The more Zen you do, the less you identify with yourself, and the more you identify with this system, like a complex system that you're part of. It's like your identity shifts from the me to the system, and you realize you're part of something bigger. See, I mean, we're a little bit like leaves on a tree, right? That think we're the tree. We're a little like leaves on a tree, and our attitude towards the other leaves is both competitive and anxious, right? And we're so afraid that we're not as good as the leaves next to us on the tree that we worry about it all the time. And maybe we're so obsessed with being a leaf that we don't notice we're part of the tree. You know, our real identity is tree, not leaf. Well, humans are like that. You know, we don't understand. We're living the leaf life when we could be living the tree life. You know, the more you do zazen, the more you get out of the leaf mentality and you participate in the tree mentality. See? You were born at a certain day as Kurt, and you will die at a certain day as Kurt. But you have no birth and no death. There's a part of you that has no birth and no death. It's not the small part, it's the big part. And the more zazen you do, the more you step outside of the small part and return yourself to the bigger part. It's what's so thrilling about this. It's why people feel, they don't understand it, but it's why people feel so good when they enter samadhi. It's like rediscovering your true nature. Is this in the Diamond Sutra? It says it's like an enormous body. You know, your true nature is the enormous body of the, you could say, the universe. Right? You know, in the sutras it says Buddha worlds. There are more Buddha worlds, there are more planets, basically, with sentient beings, than there are atoms in the Ganges River. And there are more universes with planets, etc., than atoms in the Ganges. That's what the sutras say. And all of them are your true body. What a pity, then, that we live in this small self so often. So it all starts with watching the breath and entering deep samadhi. And the what makes that so wonderful, or one of the things that makes that so wonderful, is that you get outside of your small self and you begin to participate in the larger self. See, which is what Lin Ji called this true person of no rank. See. And the more time you spend on the cushion, the more you shift from like that little self to the big self, from the leaf to the tree, from the part to the system. You realize you identify with the system. You experience yourself as part of the system. There's a part of you that will live, you know, hopefully 75, 80 years, and there's a part of you that has no birth and no death. So please spend as much time as you can in that part. Please take good care of your small self, but please take really good care of your true nature. Taking a thief for one's son, taking the servant for the master, can a broken wooden ladle be your ancestor's skull? This is common sense, see? Separating this from that, high from low, distinguished from undistinguished, successful from failure, you know, success from failure, wealthy from poor. See, a donkey saddle rim is not your father's jawbone either. This is how ordinary people think. Everything is separate from everything else. But Lin Ji said to the assembly, there is a true person with no rank going out and in through the portals of your face. Beginners who have not yet witnessed it, look. A monk came forward and said, what is the person of true rank? Lin Ji got down from the seat, grabbed him and held him. The monk hesitated. See, he hasn't found it yet. Or he's gone into samadhi, but he doesn't get it yet. Lin Ji pushed him away and said, the true man of no rank, what a dry piece of crap he is. He's really saying, you know, don't live in the small self. You know, don't do that. You're always the true person of no rank. It's so sad when the universe fritters away eternity because it doesn't have, you know, because its ears are too big or its nose is too long, right? What a pity. Delusion and enlightenment are opposite, subtly communicated with simplicity. Spring opens the 100 flowers in one puff. Power pulls back 9 bulls in one yank. It's hopeless. The mud and the sand can't be cleared away. Clearly blocking off the eye of the sweet spring, if suddenly it burst forth, it would freely flow. Inside of you, there's like a something that wants to get out. It's what made you come here and practice Zen this morning. It's what made you drive through the snow. Its name isn't Kurt. It has no birth and no death. Please, please live in that place.